morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. A couple minutes late, but we have a little mechanical today. It's January 24th, 2020. We got 6 minutes after 9 a.m. We have a dysfunctional projector or something in the system for allowing the slides to be shown on the screen. So for the public at home, you'll have to go online, whatever, to see these slides. But, we're going to continue on with today's presentation. So it may be a little more difficult to follow than normal, unfortunately. But with me today is my co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Wilson, Senator Wilikowski. We're joined today by Senator Stevens and the Senate President, Senator Giesel. We have one presentation today, and we're going to talk about the state debt. And we have asked the state debt manager from the Department of Revenue to prepare a presentation for us, which he did, and if he'll come forward, Mr. Mitchell. In the event that Mr. Mitchell is stumped by a question from the committee, he has brought with him the acting commissioner of revenue as a lifeline. So feel free if you feel you happen to need one, but if you need one, I'll be surprised, because you have done this once or twice to the committee before. So with that, Mr. Mitchell, if you could introduce yourself for the record, and since this is the first time this year you've been here, just real briefly tell the kind of the public your tenure at the state and kind of your background, so they're kind of familiar with yourself.
Thanks. So for the record, my name is Devin Mitchell. I'm the debt manager for the state of Alaska in the Department of Revenue. I have been in my current position since 1998, initially in an acting capacity and then ultimately designated the debt manager, among other things, a couple of years later, or a year and a half later. So since early 2000, I've been the debt manager for the state of Alaska. I was born and raised in Alaska, and I went to college in northern Arizona and Flagstaff. Came back after school and have worked for the state of Alaska for around 27 years at this point. And so today I did have a PowerPoint presentation, which apparently is not going to work, but you all have a handout, I assume. And so the intent of the presentation today is to go over debt and outstanding debt of the state of Alaska, because a lot of times people aren't familiar with that, although I think we've talked about that before this committee annually in all recent years, and then talk a little bit about debt capacity and rating agency process for the state. And so the state has a credit rating from the three major rating agencies, and discuss how they're viewing us at this point and pros and cons of how we portray ourselves. So to begin, all state debt must be authorized by the legislature. That authorization then, in certain instances for general obligation bonds, must be ratified by the electorate. And all state debt is issued by the State Bond Committee, which is a committee comprised of three commissioners, the Commerce, Admin, Administration, and Revenue. The state also has a couple of other obligations that are based on a statutory framework consisting of the school debt reimbursement program, and there's another reimbursement program that was kind of a one-off from the early 2000 that we call the DOT or capital reimbursement program, that was much smaller than the school debt reimbursement program. Both of those programs are supported by municipal general obligation debt, and so they're ultimately payable by local revenues if the state doesn't have money or doesn't transfer money to those communities on an annual appropriation basis, which has occurred multiple times, most recently in the current fiscal year. But as early as 1983, for the first time, that wasn't fully funded. During the early 90s, wasn't funded for a series of years. More recently, it's fortunately been fully funded, allowing for capital investment in school projects around the state. The other major category of obligation relates to the retirement systems of the state, the public employee and teachers' retirement systems, where in the early 2000s, unfunded liabilities were recognized. And since that time, there have been a series of actions taken to limit future liabilities as well as address the outstanding liability and work towards a fully funded pension system, which has an amortization that currently ends in 2038. And I didn't say, but I'm sure the committee knows at the beginning, if you have questions on anything, always ask. Maybe at that point in time, the question comes to you through the chair, of course, since it otherwise
goes. When they have a question, I'll flag you. You just
okay.
Do your slides and I'll run the meeting.
Thank you. And so on it's page 3 of the numbered presentation, we have a table that comes out of the State Debt Book, which is an annual publication of Treasury Division in the Department of Revenue that's required by statute. It's categorized from the highest commitment of payment or highest commitment of credit to really the lowest commitment of credit. And so state general obligation bonds are listed first, and we currently have about $670 million outstanding. That's a reduction of about $54 million from last year. So we have a declining outstanding balance at this point on an annual basis. The next category is state guaranteed debt, and that's comprised of a program, the Veterans Mortgage Loan Program, which, again, has to be voted on by the electorate to authorize these bonds to be issued. It's managed by AHFC and is supported by payments made by the mortgage holders. So the veterans that obtain mortgages through this program have paid all the debt service related to these bonds. And it allows for tax exemption to be utilized for purposes of funding those mortgages, and so they have lower rates than would otherwise be available. There's about $106 million outstanding today, and that's a $60 million increase from last year. Under state-supported debt, and that's debt where the state's committed its credit to pay, but on a subject-to-appropriation basis, and so it's not constitutional debt, which we'll be probably talking about more later in this presentation, but it is a debt recognized by the market and in a construct that's recognized the market. And so certificates of participation, that's for a facility in Anchorage, $22 million outstanding, a reduction of $2 million from last year, and then lease revenue bonds, which is comprised of Goose Creek Correctional Facility as well as the parking garage in Anchorage through AHFC that has about $193 million outstanding, a $10 million reduction from last year. Under state-supported municipal debt, that's the school debt reimbursement program and this other capital reimbursement program. For purposes of this publication, because there is a lack of clarity on how this program might evolve into the future or whether or not it will be partially or fully funded into the future, we just assume it's going to be fully funded for purposes of this publication. And so these numbers don't try to come up with any adjustments that could be made. So $704.8 million outstanding for the school debt reimbursement program, a reduction of $65 million from last year, and $22.5 million in the other program, a reduction of $3.5 million from last year. Pension system funding, this is the June 30, 2018 valuation for PERS and TERS, and this isn't necessarily all the state's liability because there are many PERS employers, and there are also, the state is a percentage of the TERS employer category is relatively small, even though the state funds education, primarily funds education. And so these numbers total about $6.7 billion at June 30, 2018, and that was a reduction of about $260 million from the prior year, and that was really related to some adjustments made actuarially due to assumptions about health care or other post-employee benefits. I understand that there's a preliminary June 30, 2019 valuation, and it's a slightly smaller number, maybe $6.5 billion. So that, fortunately, isn't growing like it did at some points in the past that Mr. Chairman recalls, I'm sure. Under state moral obligation debt, this is another statutory framework that's required to support these that's recognized by the market, where you require in statute that there be a reserve fund and a reporting on a reserve fund to secure a bond issue. The market sees that structure in statute and says, aha, this is a moral obligation, where it's not explicitly backed by the state's credit, but it is implied that in the event of a failure of the underlying credit to be able to pay, that the state would step in and replenish that reserve fund. And if the state failed to do so, it would be dinged. It would have a reduction made to its credit worthiness or its credit rating. The largest borrower in this category is the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank. Those are primarily loans to municipalities for local capital projects that are paid back by local revenues. There's about $1.1 billion outstanding in that program, which is a reduction of about $30 million from last year. The AEA borrowing is for Bradley Lake on the Kenai Peninsula, and then the student loan program, and both of those had reductions as well, $10 and $12 million. Under state revenue debt, and revenue debt in Alaska is difficult because of the prohibition on dedicating revenues, and so in order to dedicate revenue, you have to have a pre-existing revenue dedication prior to statehood or a federally mandated dedication requirement, and so that's where we are able to borrow under the sportfish revenue bonds, is because sportfish licensure fees are dedicated to sportfish management by federal law. And then the international airport revenue bonds, which was in place prior to statehood and had debt outstanding at statehood, and those are the two primary categories of revenue debt. And the sportfish revenue bonds, there's about $13.9 million outstanding at June 30, 2019, $3 million reduction from the prior year. The remainder of the bonds are currently payable or callable on April 1st, 2020, this year. And the last time I checked, there was about $11.7 million available for the payment of that final obligation or that final that optional redemption. And so we do anticipate those bonds being fully repaid during fiscal or the calendar year 2020. The surcharge that was implemented to provide for the repayment of these bonds sunsets at that point, per statute that was enacted back in 2005, 2006. And so the cost of a sport fishing license will either go down or have to be repurposed. That revenue would have to be repurposed or reauthorized. The international airport system, I don't know that many people recognize this, but it's actually the debt of the system is issued by the State Bond Committee. The system itself is managed by the Department of Transportation with airport directors and a controller at the system level. I'm currently working with the airport system on refinancing some bonds that will become callable on October 1st, about $100 million of bonds, and that we project savings in the current market to be around $10 to $14 million. And so we'll be moving towards making air travel and that system more efficient into the future, and that actually The airport system and some of the interaction that's gone on behind the scenes during the Great Depression or the recession of the United States, where transfers through the system for cargo from Asia to the continental U.S. were under duress, we were able to work with airport management to diminish the landing fee requirement for the system relatively significantly for a period of years through the use of resources and debt restructuring, which allowed the airport to remain more competitive than it otherwise would and retain traffic that it otherwise might have lost. And so there's been a good relationship with the airport system.
Okay, before you go on to the next slide, we have questions from Senator Bishop, Senator Olson, and Senator Wilikowski. These two slides are kind of combined, but we'll just do this slide, then we'll go to the next one, and because there's quite a list. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, good morning. The Alaska Energy Authority bonds 1 through 8, did they all terminate at the same time?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I'm not entirely sure. There are multiple series of bonds, and so I believe that there was the most recent issue related to a modest increase, or maybe not modest, but it was megawatts of power increase in the dam's capability to generate electricity, and so I'd need to get back to you on the specific dates, but I believe that they're staggered.
Thank you.
And we'll probably have a few questions, but then you could put them all together and get back to the committee and we'll disperse them out. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, I realize that this total debt is dated June 30, 2019, but if you look at the state-supported municipal debt that's about the middle of the page there, how are these figures impacted by the school debt service that the governor vetoed, which is out after that date?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, and so it doesn't impact, these are the balances outstanding. What it impacted was the annual debt service, and so the annual debt service associated with the school debt reimbursement program, off the top of my head, about $100 million, and so about $50 million of that, because of the veto, was otherwise paid or will be paid during this fiscal year by local jurisdictions, local taxpayers. The other capital project program, that was 100% reduction, and so that annual debt service in FY20 is about $4.5 million, and so that'll be paid either by ratepayers, because there's certain enterprise activity that's included in that program, electrical generation projects, as well as some port and harbor projects, as well as well as some general obligations that would be paid by local revenues.
Last question, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
As we look at these vetoes that the governor did, as you outlined, it looks like the electorate is on the hook for them. What happens if by the end of the day these vetoes are overridden? Does it have an effect on the debt that's there or the service?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it won't make a difference to these numbers because these numbers reflect the entire balance outstanding. It will just, for some municipalities that have already paid, they should have already all paid some portion of their debt service this fiscal year, because you have two payments of interest and one payment of principal typically. But they'll in essence receive in some ways a windfall, because they were, I would assume, planning for the worst case scenario where they wouldn't get the 50% reimbursement.
That's if the override is sustained.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you consider the cashable oil tax credits, or does your department consider them to be debt? I don't see them listed on here.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, we do consider them an obligation, and that's something that we haven't incorporated into this spreadsheet. The reason that we consider them as an obligation is because they're included in our net position analysis in the work that they do preparing the CAFR. But that's a good question and something that probably warrants consideration. And as this is a working document, so we didn't used to provide information in this document on PERS or TERS liabilities either. And so it is something that's worth considering including in this summary.
And I think if I could add a little bit to that, because that hasn't been finalized by the courts, if I'm interpreting the question correctly, the roughly $700 million, is that what you're asking about, Senator Wilkowski? So I guess when it's settled out, it'll either be a bond issue or we'll be paying it in cash at the table over time. We'll have to make sure it's properly disclosed where it's supposed to be so the committee can understand the full position of the state, and we talked about that actually yesterday a little bit. You had a follow-up, Senator Wilkowski?
I do, yeah, and if the state wins that lawsuit, then it would be considered debt for sure, but if the state loses the lawsuit and doesn't pay, let's say, or pays on a longer, maybe over 20 or 30 years, does the failure to pay that the taxable credits or oil tax credits impact the state's credit rating?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I don't believe that it would.
Thank you.
Okay. So next slide.
Okay, so the slide numbered 4, which is, as you said, a continuation of the table, the University of Alaska debt, which is supported by revenues derived by the university. There's about $287 million in a couple of categories, and there was a reduction of about $13.5 million last fiscal year in that state agency debt. And these are obligations that really are not backstopped by the state of Alaska, but they are issued by entities that the state of Alaska created. And of these, the Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation, which is a subsidiary of AHFC, was specifically created to remove this liability from or put it further from the state itself because it was this bond issuance was supported by a sale of a portion of a settlement agreement that the state was a party to in exchange for a one-time payment. And we did not want to have that settlement agreement potential diminishment in the future have an impact on the state as a result of issuing this debt, meaning that we didn't want to pay this debt service out of other resources in the event that the settlement agreement revenues are deficient. And so these really are things that I wouldn't expect the state to try to pay in the event of a default unless there were other policy matters that were afoot that warranted such consideration. And then state agency collateralized or insured debt, and I'm sorry, in the prior category of state agency debt, there was a reduction of $40 million, about $440 million outstanding at this point. State agency collateralized or insured debt, and that's primarily AHFC's programs where they issue bonds and then put those mortgages into a trust that collateralizes or pays for the bonds and repays the investors. And so they're secured by separate revenue streams from again, the state of Alaska. And there would be, a lower expectation of any state impact or state support specifically required in the event of a default in this category. But, again, it was issued by a state entity, and so there would be consideration required. And that category of issuance actually increased about $73 million, and that was really related to mortgage activity at AHFC. So a indicator of their meeting their mission. And so if there are no questions, moving to the next slide, 5, which is just
before we jump to that slide, there's been some concern at the committee over the years of the potential issuance of bonds that have already been approved by the legislature. I think it's in the tune of possibly billions. It would be nice to have you update the committee on that in your answers, just as a reminder. And I recognize that some of the authorities, like the Alaska Railroad, may never issue them due to or various reasons, but it would be nice for the committee to be briefed because it is a staggering amount, as I recall.
So, Mr. Chair, just so I understand correctly, so the Alaska Railroad authorization was for a pipeline, natural gas pipeline, because there was some potential that they could access tax-exempt bond even though there's private activity. So are you talking about any authorization that's currently outstanding, which would be a wider net than just those authorizations that the state would pay or maybe have a subcategory? So, for example, there's pension obligation bonds, which are still authorized, up to $1.5 billion. Those would be paid by the state of Alaska in place of.
I would include those. I was thinking actually those in the railroad issue because they're colossal, both of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's no expiration window on them. I think that was an oversight at the committee. We should have some expiration dates on this stuff.
I would agree with you. So this slide really just shows the mature nature of the general obligation debt program of the state. So you can see that we have declining outstanding debt service, and every year declines on average around $40 million a year. This is viewed as a very conservative structure and has the potential, if there were stability of revenue, for a significant additional borrowing. If you, for example, said, oh, I think that having an outstanding balance of $500 million of bonds was acceptable and filled that in out to 2028, you can see that we've used about half of that potential capacity at that level. And so when we talk to rating agencies or investors, this is something that we highlight as a strength of the state. And the fact that we have net debt service of about $78 million that declines to $12 million per year during the same time frame. On the following page six, we have a couple of charts, and these charts are really designed to show how relatively insignificant all of the obligations of the state are in comparison to the PERS TERS liability. That on the top, you can see we have a general fund paid debt service by category, state GOs, state supported, or state supported municipal debt. And again, this is the full amount of municipal debt, no haircut. And it's from the time frame of 2000 through final maturity. So it's a historical and prospective chart. And you can see that the largest category of debt service has been in the school debt or the reimbursement side rather than on the state side. And then that we're currently about $100 million on each side of that. So $100 million of state-supported debt directly and then $100 million of reimbursement. And then that diminishes gradually through 2038. And then in the chart down on the bottom, it's hard even to see where that $200 million in 2020 exists. It's in the very bottom beneath the blue that extends out through 2040. And the blue is the PERS TERS commitment of the state that, again, is if there were a way to consider addressing the PERS TERS liability, it would be beneficial to the state and the state's credit. It's universally noted in reading reports that Alaska has a relatively large unfunded pension liability, and that's in regard to the size of our population and the size of the liability and then the size of our economy.
Before we go to the next slide, Senator Bonimoff.
So thank you. When you say relatively large for the size of the population, when you look at other states, there are periodicals out there that compare all 50 states, and there is definitely commentary on the various different states about how far states may be underwater or not. Generally, what I'm seeing is that Alaska's neither good nor bad. It's sort of like meh. So I don't know if there's a financial term for meh, but It wasn't, there was not a huge alarm, and I remember us talking last year, you even mentioned it, alluded to it earlier, due to less health care pressures, our payment actually had less pressure and it went down for this year. So I guess, are you also reading these 50 state comparisons, and where are you finding Alaska other than per capita, but it just overall being underwater or not?
Through the chair, Senator von Imhoff, I don't see, or I haven't been studying analysis of the 50 states' pension systems, but generally what I am aware of is when rating agencies look at our pension liability, they tend to use a lowered discount rate. So instead of assuming that we're going to earn 8, which is now 7.38, they assume that we'd earn something less because they want to be conservative in their analysis, and then they compare the liability that how they believe it should be amortized. So they, in some instances, think our amortization is too long, and that maybe we're not keeping up with even the interest that's accruing in some scenarios. So meaning that if you were assuming that we were going to that unfunded liability was earning whatever 7.38%, and that 7.38% of the liability equaled $300 million, and we put in $250 million. Well, we didn't keep up with the interest that accrued on the liability, and that's been noted in reports in the past. And then it is, like I said, relative to the size of the population and the economy, which is how they tend to try to homogenize between states. Even though Alaska has this sidebar of extraordinary wealth from oil generation and investment income, they tend to not incorporate that as well into their scorecards. And as a result, we wind up with a mention in our credit reports that we're relatively less well off with pension liabilities.
So we understand that some of us have concerns over the haircut of the annual contribution the last few years to our pension plan and the restating of some schedules that frankly helped us get into the bind two decades ago, doing this sort of maneuver. So there is some concern with that. But on the other hand, taking a look at our vast savings account, the permanent fund, and virtually discounting it, when we're the only state that has that magnitude of wealth per capita, I think is a huge oversight. And they may rank us differently, and we encounter that, but that, you know, I guess that's their choice. But we're not going broke anytime soon. In my lifetime or your children's lifetime. So I wouldn't have, my recommendation to the public is don't stay up too late at night worrying about that. It's not happening. And we're not going to skip our obligations because of our wealth accumulation.
There is a note on this slide, and there's another slide later, of other existing authorizations. It's that final bullet, the $300 million for the Knik Arm Crossing. These are limited, though, to those obligations that you would anticipate the state's general fund paying for. And so the Knik Arm Crossing had a $300 million authorization that is still on the books, and it allows it was envisioned as a subordinate lien on toll collections of a project that would build a bridge across the Knik Arm that you would anticipate tolls to be insufficient to cover. Meaning that there would be enough to cover other debt, but not this debt, and that even though you had that pledge, the state's subject to appropriation commitment would backstop those bonds, and so you would fully anticipate that you would be paying debt service out of the general fund. There's a remaining $110 million authorization for general obligation bonds relating to the 2012 Transportation Act. There's the already referenced $1.5 billion POB and the already referenced $1 billion tax credit certificate bond corporation bonds.
Okay. Senator Wilkowski, before the next slide.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does having these existing authorizations out there impact our credit rating?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it definitely is something that is noted from time to time. The rating analysts, similar maybe to legislators, forget if you don't talk about a specific authorization for a period of time. If you're talking about that authorization, they recall. It's something that can influence the ratings discussion, but doesn't day to day. They don't go, oh, I see that you have these remaining authorizations outstanding.
I think we'll wait and see what that list looks like when Mr. Mitchell gets back to us. We may at some point want to have a hearing on just that subject matter, and if it's of such interest to the committee, put forth a recommendation to try to rein some of it in, or at least put a window of termination on some of it. But we can do that as, you know, it's not time sensitive, so, but it would be something the committee should consider possibly.
And Mr. Chair, I can't speak for the administration, but me personally, I believe that would be a good thing to pursue, meaning that otherwise, or because otherwise we find ourselves and this happened a few years ago, crosswise with the legislature, something's authorized, we think, oh, it's authorized, we can go do that. Well, maybe the legislature doesn't think we should do that anymore. And so in many ways, if you haven't done something within a year or two of its authorization that is going to obligate the state and have a financial commitment out of the general fund to pay, then maybe it should be something that the legislature has to approve again.
So we'll look at that. We could talk to the Commissioner of Revenue and get his thoughts, and we'll just see how that plays out. But it is something we should pay attention to. Okay, go ahead and continue.
On the following slide, this is just a summary of a couple of short-term obligation alternatives. Bond anticipation notes, that's where you have debt that's authorized by the legislature and is eligible for issuance, and you don't want to issue long-term debt for whatever management reasons you might have, we can issue bond anticipation notes, which we did in 2013, 14, and 15 for the 2012 Transportation Act as a management tool for financial reasons. The revenue anticipation notes is a little more interesting. It's a tool where statutes allow us to borrow money intra-fiscal year in years where there's a cash deficiency. And this does, in some ways, dovetail into other discussions on the CBR and how it's been utilized historically. There is the potential of a benefit to the state, a financial benefit from using revenue anticipation notes. And the largest municipality in the state, Anchorage, issues a tax anticipation note annually. Even though they have enough money to pay for their fiscal year needs, they borrow intra-fiscal year because they can borrow tax exempt. They can keep their money invested taxably, so they have a taxable rate, and so they have the difference between those two rates is extra revenue for their municipality to utilize. The difficulty with the state considering that type of undertaking is that you have to include all revenue, not revenue that we categorize as revenue, and there's a slide in here later about how we categorize revenue. You can't pretend you don't have revenue because it's revenue utilized for something specific or revenue that you have saved historically. It's still revenue, and so it's likely that even in FY21, where we have a governor's budget that has a $1.5 billion deficit, UGF deficit, that if you include revenue from the revenue sources book that is otherwise being saved or not categorized as available, there is not a deficit in FY21. So you wouldn't be able to borrow on a tax-exempt basis in that scenario. these types of...
Just a second, Senator. Are you done with this slide?
I was just going to mention we haven't issued these types of obligations since the 60s.
So you have more to say on the slide? Or?
No.
Okay, you're done. Okay, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. You mentioned the Constitutional Budget Reserve account. We are obligated to pay that back. Is that noted any place, and is there an amount that is noted that we are obligated to pay?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that's another good question. It's not noted, and probably the biggest reason that it's not noted is that it's an obligation that we are lending to ourselves, and so even though there is a constitutional framework for it, there is an allowance within that framework that we can ignore it. And so that's generally what happens year to year, or else it would be repaid right now.
And how many billions are we talking about?
It's many billions. I'm not sure of the final number at this point. It is noted in the CAFR, as my lifeline pointed out, and it's around $10 billion.
For those watching at home, there's no interest charge on that. It's held within our accounts, and like was mentioned, we borrow from ourselves at no interest and no timeline to pay it back. But we had paid it back at one time several years ago and accumulated a significant surplus or increase. Amount, and not really a surplus, but increased amount. And at $10 billion or so today, or whatever it is, or north, there probably won't be any debt service payments on that anytime soon. Senator Von Imhoff, do you have a question?
No. Yeah.
That's fine. Go ahead and continue, Mr. Mitchell.
Okay. So that concluded the overview of outstanding debt and moves us to state debt capacity. There's another publication that my office puts out, the debt affordability analysis. Again, it's required by statute, an annual publication. And it's been difficult in recent years because of the evolution that's been underway within the state as far as how revenues are categorized, what are revenues. Senate Bill 26 is probably the biggest most impactful change that's occurred, but even with Senate Bill 26, there's a lack of structure around how revenue that might be available as a result of that statutory construct with a percent of market value draw on the earnings out of the earnings reserve from the permanent fund, that makes it very difficult to say, okay, here's how much money is available, here's how much money is off the table. And so we did in 2019 reduce some of the ratios that we use from 5 to 4, 8 to 7% to determine what debt capacity might be. And I'm not, in my view, it's even with those reductions, it still might overstate capacity without downgrade in the current scenario or the current situation we find ourselves in. So these ratios churn out a capacity of around $2.8 billion over the next 10 years. And so that's a huge number. But right out of the gate, as Senator Wilikowski noted earlier, you have $1 billion of authorization for a tax credit corporation structure. And we also have $100 million of GOs yet to issue that are authorized. And so that reduction brings us down to around $1.7 billion of theoretical capacity. But again, it would be a lot easier if there were more sideboard on how we were moving into the future than we have right now. And I think everybody recognizes that, and it's a difficult task, but structure is good. Structure with flexibility is better, and being able to portray that accurately into the future is critical to being able to forecast what we might be able to do in the future. The book discusses a number of aspects related to capacity, and if you're interested in reading, I don't see anybody with it, but it's available on Treasury's website under debt management, both that and the state debt book for this year as well as past years.
So just as a comment, Alberta, when they dealt with the imploding oil prices and ran significant deficits, went out and rather than reduce their operating budget, just borrowed the money to fill the hole and kept going. They're in a predicament today I don't know how they're going to get out of. So we might have extra capacity, but some of us would be very concerned if we started piling on a lot more debt.
So. And I would agree with you, Mr. Chair, that the debt, again, makes sense, and especially in our construct where we have a large invested tax-exempt fund, endowment, if you will, where we can borrow tax-exempt if you have structure and you're borrowing for things you otherwise would have paid for, that are necessities, not niceties. And again, that's very difficult given our makeup, but it definitely, as part of a rational, ongoing program, makes a lot of financial sense to take advantage of debt to allow us to retain resources, but it should, meaning other money that we would invest on a taxable basis, but it shouldn't be in addition to what we otherwise would do. On the next page, this is really a look back at the past and is describing how that change in from Senate Bill 26 changed ratios from 2017 forecast to the fall 2019 forecast. And so you can see we went from, you know, these expectations of $2 to $2.8 billion of revenue growing to expectation of $5 to $6 billion of revenue. And that change is due to the inclusion of the percent of market value transfers from the permanent fund. If you back out the dividend projection, and some of these might include more than just this is actually the transfer. If this is the back out the POMV transfer, it reduces capacity in these blue charts. If you actually calculate the difference between that and 5%, you know, the blue charts 3.17 in 2020 to 5%, what is that incremental capacity allow you to borrow, or 6.4% in the 8% cap to 8, it's a much lower debt capacity, $622 million to $1.2 billion in total. And so when you back out the POMV transfer, it has a significant reduction in capacity, and arguably authorized debt would fully utilize that capacity. And so again, it just highlights the importance of having structure around how that POMV revenue is going to be available or not. And on the next page, I talked about this a little bit earlier. This is just a slide that we used historically because of the way the state categorizes revenue, that we've had this, I think, blessing in many ways of conservatism baked into our structure, that we look at each other and say we have a deficit and we might have a draw out of the CBR, and this is back in the 90s, mind you, not today, but back in the 90s we'd say we have a deficit, we've got to draw $200 million out of the CBR. And then you would look at how much money was earned in the CBR and how much deposits were into the CBR, and it'd be $400 million. So we'd be like, well, we had a deficit, which we told everybody we had a deficit, when really we put $400 million of current year revenue into the bank, so we had a net draw of $200 million. And that didn't even include the permanent fund back then. And still today, we have had this rejiggering as a result of Senate Bill 26, where now we are including certain revenues, or the POMV category of revenue from the permanent fund, but it's not total revenue from that's anticipated by the permanent fund itself. If you look at the revenue sources book, there's about $1.3 billion that's expected to be earned in FY21 that is categorized as restricted. And under the structured draw scenario, don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting it shouldn't be restricted, but it's available in the sense of it could be appropriated. And it's money that came in versus money going out. It is money coming in. And that we don't tell the folks looking at us in our official publications that we do tell them we have that revenue, but it's hidden in the book rather than highlighted in the book. And in addition to that, you have, like I spoke to earlier, deposits into the CBRF and earnings of the CBRF, and deposits into the permanent fund, some of which are constitutionally mandated and some of which are statutorily mandated, that the combination of which is going to result in us saving more money potentially than we declare as a deficit in FY21. And again, I'm not talking about any change to that. I'm just saying when I'm talking about the state credit to third parties, the strength of the state is hidden in those publications and difficult to draw out at times.
I wouldn't use the word hidden in publications. You may want to use terms like less apparent. Because we don't hide stuff in the revenue source book. We actually publish in the revenue source book so people can see it and find it and look at it and argue about it and talk about it and have presentations on it. There's really nothing hidden in the book. To some some stuff is less apparent than others.
Hard to find.
Point taken. It is definitely in there. On the following page, this is just the 2020 debt affordability analysis inputs. So you have the general obligation debt service for 2020 through 29, the lease purchase payments, and you can see those as they progress through time, the capital leases, the school debt reimbursement, and capital project reimbursements, and then the projected PERS TERS payments, and then those flow down into the lower chart that turns the percentages of unrestricted general fund revenue as it's characterized in the revenue sources book at this point. And you can see that we're below our targets for both categories, the 4% and the 7% caps. And we, as far as when you include the pension fund commitments, again, it dwarfs the other debt commitments that we have or payment commitments that we have, but it's within parameters that I have looked at other states on how what percentage of revenues they might pay for outstanding debt service in combination with past liability associated with their pension funds, and we are in a neutral or a meh category with those for this payment percentage.
Question, Senator Bellamy.
Thank you. On this particular slide, sometimes on the very far right-hand side, it'd be nice to have a total.
Yes.
Of everything. And I do really appreciate your very last comment about neutral or net. It is, you know, we are unique, but at the same time, it's sometimes nice to see how we are with our peers. Good, bad, or different. It's what it is. It's consistent over time, because when you can start seeing how we are either going outside the boundaries, and I think we know that at this point maybe we're pushing the boundaries a little bit much. We're not now, obviously, but still, sometimes it's just nice to have a sense of our peers.
So we have consumed 2/3 of our time allotment this morning, and we've gone through 50% of our presentation. Not that anybody's
yes.
counting or comparing, but I'd like to finish up here in 25 minutes, and I'll watch the clock and speed it up if it looks like we're going a little too slow. So you don't have to accelerate to full speed, but we'll just pick it up a little bit.
Perfect. So the next slide, we already really talked about that, and we'll expand this list so that it includes other obligations that aren't necessarily paid by the state of Alaska. The following slide is just a summary of the history of the Alaska Tax Credit Bond Corporation, the fact that it was created due to the 2016 scenario where the historical practice of paying most of the credits annually wasn't feasible any longer, or it was determined not to be feasible, and we started paying based on the statutory formula, and that wasn't anticipated by industry and resulted in duress, and that this corporate structure was derived with both the state's interest as well as the credit holders' interests in mind, meaning that there's a financial benefit to the state as well as the credit holders. The payments that are going to be made are going to be discounted from the stated current value, the accrued value. And so, for example, right now, and these are just indicative, and these numbers are likely to change. This was the fall 2019 revenue sources book in the third bullet. The $739 million that's currently accrued would diminish to somewhere between $583 and $660 million, depending on the discount rate, given the numbers that were in the book at that time. And so there's a significant benefit to the state. It's a lower cost of capital, or it provides capital relief to industry, hopefully allows for industry to do more in the state. The constitutionality, as was previously addressed, has been questioned for the corporation, and that's currently the Supreme Court awaiting decision. I guess it's ripe for decision is what their website says.
We've had that mentioned in the last 2 days here. The committee will be watching that along with conversations with the administration in case we have to modify the budget in front of us before we get out of here in May.
And through the chair, if it is approved, we have done work to prepare for the potential of a positive ruling. Obviously, that will all fall off the table if the ruling isn't positive. But to the extent it is, we would anticipate trying to issue bonds in the current fiscal year, and the market would expect that the legislature revalidate the structure by having an appropriation in FY21 for debt service, because it's a subject to appropriation commitment, and given some of the past disagreements between an administration and a legislature, it certainly is important to have that solidarity. And the next slide really shows just the construct of the tax credit certificate structure. And the key, it's slide 15, is the agreement between the Department of Revenue and the corporation. And that agreement is going to result in the proceeds of the money that bondholders give the corporation in exchange for their bonds to be transferred to the Department of Revenue to pay whatever amount's been determined by the Department of Revenue and the Department of Natural Resources for the outstanding credits that are going to participate in exchange for a contractual commitment to make annual payments to the corporation.
Okay, we can bring this subject back when we actually have that appropriation in front of us and review it all, and it'll be more timely at that time to go into more depth.
That sounds good, Mr. Chair. On slide 17, we have the state's credit ratings along with the 49 other states' credit ratings. The state's credit rating has slid over since 2014 in the decline in the price of oil we certainly would have had credit diminishment either way, but some of the credit diminishment we've incurred has just been because of the difficulty in defining how we're going to move forward in the new paradigm that we found ourselves. And so at this point, the state's ratings are still strong, AA3, AA, AA minus, but we're in the lower 20% rather than the top 20% of states' credit ratings at this point.
Good question. Senator Wilkowski, did you want to note that the ratings changed since
no.
the last time Senator Stedman was chairing the committee?
I know they have.
Maybe a correlation there.
I think there is. Quick question. Alaska, we're AA3 and we're negative for Moody's, and then I look at Illinois and it's a BAA3, and which is the lower, right? And they're stable. And mm-hmm. why is that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it's just a designation that the rating agencies use. They'll have negative, they'll have credit watch in certain instances, and if you look it up, it's definitional, and it has an implied probability of a ratings action in the future. Moody's put the negative outlook on this last summer not very long before Fitch downgraded us without putting us on any watch or any outlook change, and so. It was in result to the difficulty that we had as a state to get a capital budget, an operating budget, a CBR agreement, and above. And so I've talked with the Moody's analyst and the S&P analyst after the Fitch rating action was taken, and I haven't – they're watching very carefully, I guess. I mean, they're aware of the legislative session start and the governor's proposals for the legislature for the coming fiscal year, and are just watching to see how we're able to work as a state. On the next page, this is a slide that I showed in the presentation last year, and so it was in response to an investor presentation that I went to in May of 2018. I haven't been to another investor presentation since then. Spoke to a group of investors about the state and got, in part prior to that and in part during that, feedback that folks had these misperceptions about the state of Alaska that we were running out of money, that our economy was oil and that was it, and that oil was done. And that we would never be able to balance our budget. And so then these were a series of arguments that we provided, or facts, that offset those misperceptions, and had some success with that, but it's still difficult when, in large part, information is transferred through mass media, and mass media tends to like sound bites, and sound bites tend to, in our state in recent years, be pretty negative. There was one on the revenue sources book yesterday, and it was gloomy outlook. And so those are the clippings that rating analysts and investors get and see, and it then biases their opinions if they haven't done the analytics to actually dig into some of what are not as transparent to outsiders as they are to me, inferences you can make from some of our official publications. More recent rating challenges, and some of these are from, the three blue boxes are all from, or the top two are from rating reports. Political paralysis, gridlock, whatever you want to call it, that we have, we kind of have three options available to us. It seems like general options, but everybody groups together in a third, a third, a third, and it makes it very difficult to make a decision. And so we had the extended sessions in 2019, the contentious issues that everybody's aware of, I think that in some ways I thought that the end of session last year after the second special session was positive, me personally. We had a lot of people, it seemed like everybody was unhappy, and maybe that's when you have the best result. We had a diminished budget. There was some adjustment to the diminishments that were initially suggested, and there seemed to be a near balanced budget, certainly. There was still some reliance on the CBR and the SBR, but those, again, in my view, were offset by projected deposits at that time into the CBR. And so in essence, net neutral budget that was agreed on, even though it was difficult. The governor had some proposals that were viewed credit negative that weren't all approved. The legislature had some views that were credit negative that weren't all approved, and that melding, in my view, was positive. I was surprised when Fitch downgraded us. I really was. I talked to our analyst, Marcy, 2 days before that. I did not see that coming. I thought that I thought their report, if you read it, is in large part based on feeling, not analytics. There's a lot of, we believe that state actions may have this negative outcome in the future, which, like you said, Mr. Chair, people aren't going to allow to happen, yourself and others. I immediately called the other two rating agency analysts and let them know that Fitch is reading on their beliefs, their soothsaying or their tea leaves weren't correct, and that you have to look at the analytics, not the your beliefs about or the potential outcomes of a future action. So in any event, I thought a favorable response from the other two analysts. And we're, continue to work with Fitch, but it's a little discouraging, that's for sure. In addition, we have the recurring historical concerns, and again, that pension liability issue, the structural UGF imbalance, and again, we try to offset that and say, oh, well, we have other money, and they still look at what we declare officially. Narrow economy, and we try to convince them otherwise, but it's difficult when they're entrenched. And then revenue related to petroleum revenue being outsized. And in order to get to the 80-90% of UGF being oil revenue, they went back to 2014 in their report, Fitch, which again, to me, is just shoddy work, that you would try to imply that we're totally reliant on oil revenue from a 2014 revenue situation. Excuse me. And on the following slide, this is one that we use to try to hammer that point home. If you look at unrestricted surplus deficit in the middle of the page, it's...
Just a second. So you're on slide 20?
Yes. Sorry. I was
trying to follow at home.
Yeah, sorry about that, Mr. Chair. So the unrestricted surplus deficit, you can see we're in deficit from 2013 forward. And that would continue into 2019-20 and a projected 21. If you look at the change in net position in the far right-hand column, it's only negative in 2 years. And so, again, that's our strong structural makeup that mandates we save money, good times and bad. And we're saving more than we're saying our deficit is, or else we can't have an increase in net position.
Could you help clarify that last statement one more time?
The category of revenue that we call unrestricted general fund doesn't include all revenue. It's just some revenue. And some revenue that's available for the legislature to expend isn't included as unrestricted revenue. And there are valid reasons why they are categorized that way, and I'm not suggesting that the construction of that should be changed. I'm just saying it should be highlighted that that we are... At the same time, we're saying we have an unrestricted general fund imbalance. In totality, we have a surplus.
And how does the earnings reserve factor into that? It's in the permanent fund and the 5% payout on the percent of market value, particularly the earnings reserve amounts above the 5% payout.
Mr. Chair, the permanent fund factors into that hugely since it's such a significant category of revenue. I'm not, again, suggesting that the POMV structure should be amended, changed, or not followed. I'm suggesting that we should recognize that the permanent fund for the coming fiscal year is anticipating revenue that exceeds the draw by $1.3 billion. That's, I mean...
So just for clarity, the current... The fiscal year revenue, not the five-year averaging and the percent of market value, but just the
that is correct, Mr.
Silo fiscal year and look at all revenue, recurring revenue in that siloed year relative to the expenditures of that year, we would be in surplus if we calculated under that methodology.
That's correct.
Senator Hoffman.
Then how is the permanent fund earnings reserve account?
Could you pull your mic over, please?
How is the permanent fund earnings reserve account affect these? Or is that taken into consideration under the last column?
Through this chair, Senator Hoffman, so this isn't the fund balance. This is just the projected earnings or revenue.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. I think the following pages are some of the pages that we've, again, used to try to offset some of the investor concerns. And this one's just highlighting that, and again, it's difficult, and Senator Von Imhoff said this earlier, how, you know, comparing ourselves to others is good, but it's very difficult because we don't compare well. Nobody else has a permanent fund like ours. Nobody else has a population the size of ours with the size of the budget we have. the permanent fund isn't reliant on the Alaskan economy to generate revenue. So we're no longer like a New York or a California that gets revenue out of their economy. So their economy is very important to their revenue generation. And in Alaska, we have revenue generation from the world economy through a permanent fund, which is a unique situation among the states. And so that discussion we've broached and tried to forward with rating analysts. On the following slide, 22, we've given detail on the Alaska job economy. While Alaska was in recession and had job losses over the last several years, the rest of the states had a strong resurgence in their economies and very low unemployment. Our unemployment was less volatile than the rest of the states. And if you look back historically at the number of years that the state of Alaska's added jobs, it's number three of all the states as far as stability. So our state's unemployment, while it hasn't been a rosy picture the last couple of years, although it looks like it's getting better, or at least it has an indication it could be getting better in 2019, we haven't had the volatility, we haven't had the big spikes up, and we haven't had the big spikes down, which should be a credit strength, not getting a black mark for having the highest unemployment in the country when we went from, you know, 7.2 to 8% unemployment when the rest of the country went from 10 to 4. And then on the following page, 23, we have just a representation of, while the CBR has been used and has been our primary historical reserve fund for purposes of intra-fiscal year capital as well as funding for fiscal year expenditures, the permanent fund earnings reserve had significant growth during that same time frame. And while we don't want to spend it, it is still a reserve. And the big drop in 2019 was obviously the draw, the POMB draw, in conjunction with the $4 billion that was appropriated to inflation proofing, so went to principal. So it's still in the fund, it's just no longer available.
And with that note, I think there's some interest from the Finance Committee to continue moving money from the spendable portion, the earnings reserve, to the corpus, the constitutionally protected side. In excess of a billion, well north of that. And we'll be having those conversations at the table coming up over the next couple months, and I expect it to be a significant contribution to the constitutional protected portion. And we will work with the administration to try to acquire support from them to make sure that those funds are left in, or the recommendation and policy direction from the legislature, if the Finance Committee here moves forward on this, and I think it's about 99.9% certain we're going to, that transfer is signed into law.
And through the chair, from a policy perspective, that's a perfectly acceptable decision. Just from my perspective, I know that that Fitch has done a lot of analytics on the earnings reserve and the permanent fund. And again, they are unrealistic in my view on some of their analytics, like assuming that we would make no change if we had a series of negative years, which Monte Carlo simulations are only as good as, you would make changes if you started experiencing something, but certainly to the extent we make money less available, there's concern about the ability of the earnings reserve to sustain the state in the event of need for a period of multiple years over a negative cycle. And again, I don't know, that doesn't mean that your policy decisions shouldn't be to restrict money by transferring it to the principal. It's just for your information.
But we're not trying to, I don't think our policy direction is going to be to slide so much funds from the earnings reserve to the corpus to hinder the state's ability to pay dividends and operate. I think their interest is going to revolve around inhibiting the ability of some heavy spending attitudes to just start liquidating the earnings reserve because it's the easiest course of action. Senator Hoffman.
Along those lines, your last comments to the chairman's statement. As the state's debt manager, how would you make the decision on putting funds into the corpus versus paying off the a portion of the state's unfunded liability for PERS and TERS?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that's
weighing the two, if you had the choice.
There's going to be immediate rating, or the scorecard for the state's credit rating is going to have immediate positive impact from a reduction in the unfunded liability, because that's part of the analysis. Shifting money to the principal of the permanent fund from a long view is a wise thing to do. Certainly you don't want to overspend as a result of not restricting certain categories of money, but it's in the short term going to have more of a stifling or a negative impact because it would strictly be viewed on a flexibility in the event of negative experience in the future.
Senator Bishop?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to comment. There'd be plenty of time to comment on this before we're done. Thank you.
But in the event that we had a catastrophic financial failure or Mother Nature had an event that devastated the state, the people can allow access to it. But it has to be a significant reason, not just a political whim of a year or two. So the hurdle rate is extremely high, but not unsurpassable. Pretty close to unsurpassable, but.
I think that was my last slide, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you for coming forward today. We're going to, I'm sure, invite you back on particular issues as we go forward in discussion, and one of them may be what Senator Hoffman had just mentioned, trade-offs and the impact from your view as the debt manager of the state is certainly one view we don't want to overlook. And we'll be hearing from the Department of Revenue and the Permanent Fund itself in trying to formulate the policy conclusions here at the table. So I don't want anybody to think that the conclusions have been made. The direction is clear, but we have to have a lot of discussion and review before we target the amounts and timing. So tomorrow will be Saturday, but Monday, we're going to talk about the state savings position, state's cash flow position, possibly burn rates. We'll have Commissioner of Revenue here, Acting Commissioner of Revenue, I guess, technically, but I look at him as a Commissioner of Revenue. He can certainly act in that position without a problem at all. So we'll talk about that, and we'll start getting the committee familiar with cash positions. And then the following day, we'll have Office of Management and Budget. We'll come here and present the governor's proposed budget that he would like the committee to consider. And the following day from that, which will be Wednesday, we'll have legislative finance come in and talk about the governor's submission from their point of view and any areas that they may feel were inadvertently left out or additions needed or different interpretations or what have you. And so the budgetary process for this next fiscal year will be in going full speed by the middle of next week. And thanks, everybody, for coming. We'll see you 9 a.m. Monday morning. We are adjourned.